The Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome to Just Love. This is our weekly conversation on the church and the world. We think about what's going on in the world from the perspective of our Catholic social values. And as we kind of talked about last week, that when we think about those values that we kind of use as the prism to look at things, they involve the dignity of the human person. They involve issues of rights and responsibilities, the importance, the dignity of work. We talk about solidarity among nations throughout the world. We talk about family, community, and participation in civic society. And, you know, we also speak about the environment and the ecology as important values are there. And, you know, probably one of the critical ones is also that there is a preferential option for those who are struggling, those who are poor, those who are vulnerable. So kind of using that prism of what's going on, we kind of look at what's going on in the world and try to bring a little bit more awareness, a little bit more enlightenment to that. Hey, Fanny, last week you had a cold. So how's your cold now?
It's a lot better. I don't know if you can kind of still hear it in my voice.
Well, your voice always sounds wonderful and magnificent. So
thank you. So angelic.
Yeah. Well, let's not go that far. Because remember, there are bad angels.
Yeah, right? That's true.
Right. It's more like, you know, solid.
Okay, good.
That's what it sounds like.
Good.
Solid. So with your cold, it just sounds a little bit more solid than usual.
That's good.
I like that. So
I guess I'll keep it.
Well, you don't got any choice. So you might as well embrace it.
Yeah,
because
I should.
It is. Good. Jake, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Monsignor.
Yeah. Did you cook anything special?
I made a whole chicken pie.
Okay. Speak about it.
Yeah.
I can get a whole chicken.
Yeah.
And I can get chicken pot pie.
Right.
So it must have been some crust that you put around the whole chicken.
I did. I stuffed it. I seasoned. I stuffed a bird. I made a pie crust from scratch. I wrapped the whole bird in a pie crust.
Wow.
And then I baked it.
So it's Pollo Wellington.
Yeah, basically. Pollo Wellington.
Right.
Yeah. I even put mushrooms in the recipe, even though I didn't call for it. So, yeah, I made like a sauce for it, mashed potatoes. Turned out really – first time I ever did it. Turned out really good.
Wow. Yeah. That's a good deal. It turned out good?
Yeah.
So did you bring us some?
I did not.
He ate it all.
He ate it all. Oh, well.
I brought you pictures. I don't know if that's counts.
Okay.
You can live vicariously for me 3 days
counts,
ago.
It counts a little bit. You know why I'm a little bit more in tune to food this week. I'm in tune to food because we have our kind of, at Catholic Charities, we have our annual cook-off.
Oh, nice.
Between somebody else in our office and myself. And our listeners can't see this, but I had a line of duty injury over the weekend because as I was cutting the meat to prepare it, I missed the meat and I got my thumb. So it's getting better. It's fine, but it was needed a few stitches. So it was anyway. But
stitches.
Yeah.
What kind of meat was it?
It was a rump roast that I was cutting into stew pieces.
Oh.
So because we have different stuff, but we always cook the same thing as part of the cook-off.
Sure.
So this year it's beef stew.
Oh wow.
So I was cutting the rump roast into beef stew.
So did you win?
No, it's tomorrow. It's the end of the week.
Oh, so we'll find out whether it was in vain
or
not.
Week.
Yeah,
right.
Next week. We'll find out. So nice. I'm going for the sympathy vote.
Yeah. Show them the thumb.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm going for the sympathy vote. So anyway, that was my. So listen, one of those values that I talked about is community participation. And so I'm delighted that we're going to speak about what's going on kind of in the new Congress and how do we figure out if our government is actually working? Are there recommendations to make it more so? And so I'm delighted that our first guest today is Dr. Elaine Kmart, who is Senior Fellow in Governance Studies, and she's the founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institute. And she's been in Washington for a while. She worked in Washington under the Clinton administration, and she's also a lecturer in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government. So, Dr. Kamath, thank you so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted, delighted. So, you know, if you're at a center, the Brookings Institute for Effective Public Management, boy, we got some challenges today in government, don't we?
Well, you know, yes and no, because I think people realize there's two parts to the government.
Right.
There's the political functioning, which sets our priorities, does new laws, et cetera. And boy, oh boy, they're in a mess.
Right.
But then there is the professional civil service that is, even though they're in a mess in Washington, the professional service is making sure that your grandmother gets her Social Security checks on time, hospitals get paid for Medicare and Medicaid treatments. You know, in other words, the world goes on because the professional civil service keeps it going on. And that's, of course, one of the things that's so unfair about this shutdown is suddenly the people who keep the trains running on time are being punished because the people in charge can't manage to agree on things.
Yeah. So, you know, Dr. Kamath, interestingly, you say that. Yesterday, our work in Catholic Charities makes us interact a lot with government, sometimes the city, the state, federal. But yesterday I was just at a meeting with some of our city people who deal with some contracting issues. And I made the same point to them in this private meeting that you just made to our listeners, that, you know, politicians get a bad, bad rep. Government gets a bad rep. Oh, it's good enough for government, which means it's pretty lousy. But when I deal with a lot of people in government, some of them are, many of them, most of them, let me just say this, are very hardworking. They do a good job. They want to get things done. And so I thank you for that little bit of an introduction that kind of does make a distinction and doesn't paint with such a broad stroke everything that's going on in government. So thank you for kind of beginning our conversation with that. So let's move on now. So let's maybe we'll come back to the bureaucrats a little bit later on. But let's talk about that part of government, which actually does have to set the policies and, as we're learning now, has to allocate some of the funds so the managers can do their job. So what's your read on this, the new House of Representatives?
Well, it's by far and away the most diverse House of Representatives in American history. There's about 100 women in the House, which is unprecedented. It's still only a quarter, less than a quarter of the House, but still it's unprecedented. Lots of people from different backgrounds, different religions, different ethnicities. So, you know, it's reflecting what's happening in America. And it is a Democratic House, which means that it will challenge President Trump on a variety of issues, stand up to him on a variety of issues, and investigate him in a way that the Republican House was reluctant to do. So it's going to be a very exciting 2 years with a new House of Representatives.
So let me ask you in terms of not so much partisanship, but in terms of effectiveness of government. In order to get this thing right, is it better to have a lot of newcomers, or do you need more experience to figure out how you do it? Or if you're there too long, do you get in a trap and it doesn't work? You just keep doing the same thing. So how do you read? And I'm going to move on a little bit. It's not the same question, but like term limits. So is it good that we have newcomers, or does it slow things down? What's your read on that part of the effectiveness equation?
Well, that's a complicated question because, again, it depends.
Well, but you're a smart person. That's why I asked.
It depends on whether or not you're talking about the Congress or the executive branch.
Okay.
Okay, so in the executive branch, the professional civil service, in other words, the bureaucrats, you do not want term limits because you want those people to know how to make things happen. Sending out Social Security checks to millions of people on time once a month with great accuracy is, in fact, something you don't want newcomers doing all the time. It's a complicated, enormous process, and a lot of people count on getting it right. On the other hand, when it comes to Congress and when it comes to policymaking, you want a mix of the old and the new. You want new people coming in with new ideas that challenge, you know, the way things have been done. But you also want people who've been around and who can say, you know, I know that sounds like a great idea, but let me tell you what actually might happen if you do it. And so you do want a mixture in the Congress of the old and the new, and you want a mixture at the political level, not the civil service level. In the political level in the executive branch, you want a mixture of the old and the new. Some people who know how to get things done and what how policy has consequences, and some people who are bringing new perspectives.
So, Professor Kamon, I mean, one of the examples, and if people think this is partisan, so be it, but it's an area I know a little bit about, where I saw that kind of combination of people not knowing what they were doing really, really have such a disastrous effect. And that was the issuing of the travel ban on people from Muslim countries, etc. And I don't want to argue the politics or the whether it was a good idea or bad idea, but what I do want to say very clearly is, I mean, somebody should have figured out that you need to say we're going to do it in 2 weeks or a month so that you don't have people flying around in the air who don't want to come down. So, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, like, even if you want a policy, at least figure out how you do it in a way that it's a little bit, you know, you can implement it. So, you know, I think you're right. We you know, you need people who know what they're doing.
Well, that on that particular one, I mean, that's a particularly good example because that executive order was drafted without input from the professional civil servants at the Department of Homeland Security who actually have to implement this. So what happened was there were all sorts of people left in limbo or included in the language that shouldn't have been included in the language. For instance, one of the groups that I think was most hurt were there's a whole class of people who were translators for American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they have special visa privileges, as they should, because they actually helped U.S. Military over there. And they got caught up in this travel ban because it was so sloppily done. And, you know, the uncertainty, the confusion, et cetera, this is what happens when you issue policy without consultation with what I tend to call the permanent government, the civil servants, because they actually know how this stuff works at the border.
Yeah, and I think that's a very, very, you know, good example. And from the work that we do in Catholic Charities, I know that some of the people we were working with, were representing, were some of those people who were helping the New York the military of the United States in the Middle East, and they got caught up in this. It was just a crazy situation.
Well, if I could say a bit about Catholic Charities, too, which I'm very familiar with, and being Catholic and being a contributor to Catholic Charities.
Well, I got to thank you. I don't even care which one it is. I'm saying thank you on behalf of whoever whom you're making a contribution. Thank you.
Well, and Catholic Charities is a good example of why people misunderstand the federal government so much. Is a lot of money that goes out.
Now,
I
have to say, Professor Kamon, Catholic Charities gets accused of doing a lot of things. This is the first time we've ever been accused of being the cause of confusion in government.
Well, let's say it's an example of confusion.
No, okay? I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, a lot of federal money doesn't go to federal bureaucrats. It goes to nonprofits like Catholic Charities who actually run programs.
Right.
So what happens when the government shuts down, and people have to relearn this every time we have a government shutdown. Yes, some civil servants have to work without a paycheck, et cetera. But then there's a lot of groups out there, and Catholic Charities being one of the biggest, that actually don't get federal money, and therefore they can't do the important jobs in their communities that they're doing. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much federal money goes to the state and local levels and to the nonprofits around the country.
So let me pursue that a little bit, because I think that is critically too. And we have some very, very generous donors. And oftentimes when I speak to them, I say, you know, we really do need private philanthropic dollars, because while we do get a lot of government money, which we're very pleased about, the fact is that it, A, doesn't cover all costs, and it doesn't meet every need. So we kind of have to figure out a way how we blend the different sources of money in order to really help people in our communities. And so thank you for kind of raising that as a very, very important, a very important point for people to, you know, to understand. What I want to do, Professor Kamot, is to go back to that issue about the importance of kind of experience in the bureaucrats. And again, I think you know this very, very easily, but I oftentimes, when people call people bureaucrats, I think they forget that bureaucrats was actually historically a term of honor, because a bureaucrat was somebody who wasn't a kind of corrupt politician or a partisan politician or who took money to bribes, but a bureaucrat had an integrity of administering the rules in a fair, predictable, understandable way so that everybody got a fair shake at it. And so, you know, now it's got a bad name, but traditionally, if my memory serves me right, it really had a term of honor.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Look, the professional civil service was invented more than 100 years ago precisely to stop corruption in government, and precisely so that everyone who qualified under the law for a benefit, whether it was a health benefit or a pension benefit, got the benefit regardless of who you knew. In other words, you didn't have to be friends with your brother-in-law's uncle to get your Social Security check. If you qualified and you had paid into the system, you get it. And that's what bureaucrats do. They administer an impartial system. And it's why the most in every advanced economy and advanced democracy in the world, you have a professional civil service. Show me a corrupt, very poverty-stricken place where you don't want to live, and I will show you a place that is absent a professional civil servant.
Good point. Very, very good point. So now let's go a little bit further. We're speaking with Dr. Elaine Kamok, who is a senior fellow in governance studies and the founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institute, also a lecturer at the Kennedy School of Government, and who served in Washington during the Clinton years there. So let's now go forward. What I always like to do is to give smart people the opportunity to be the czar or czarina for a while. So having studied this, and, you know, admittedly, some things work in government, some things don't work in government. If right now you were the czarina and could mandate three things to make our government more effective or public management more effective, what would they be?
Do you mean policy things or process?
Well, we'll give you pick. You pick whatever you whichever you want to talk about. If you want to talk about both of them, that's fine.
Well, I think the first thing that clearly needs to happen to get us out of this rut is we need to settle on a comprehensive and humane immigration policy.
Okay.
So we need to do something about the Dreamers. We need to do something about people who are here. We need to also do something about securing the borders. Building a wall, the reason there's an impasse over the wall It's not so much because people don't believe in securing the borders. Most people do. It's because the wall is just, of all the ideas out there, one of the most ineffective ones out there. Most people come here illegally with a tourist visa, and they just they come in through an airport like anybody right. else, and they overstay their visas. So if you want to spend a couple billion dollars on something, you should spend it on that, not on a wall.
Right.
So, but we've got to sort of settle immigration. It's gotten way out of control. I mean, you've got people on the right thinking, believing that, you know, the people sneaking over the border are a bunch of murderers and rapists. You've got people on the far left saying we should have open borders, which is sort of also a bad idea. And we've got to have a sensible immigration policy. We've got to settle immigration. So I would say that is first and foremost. I think the second thing we have to do is we have to deal with inequality. There is just way too much money being made at the very top, and it's hurting everybody, and except for those the 1%. And I think the third thing we have to do is we have to build the country's infrastructure. I just came from a trip abroad over the holidays with my family, and you know, coming into Kennedy Airport from abroad, if you've been to some of these other airports around the world, right. it's just embarrassing.
It is. I mean, yeah. I mean, I you know, use Kennedy Airport enough, not all the time, but you're right. And it sums to me, if I was looking for, to me, the reason why I may not be quite as optimistic in terms of the current government situation, and maybe I'm overly focused on the policy stuff. I mean, that we can't agree to put together a robust infrastructure plan. I mean, how can anybody, whether you're on the right wing, the left wing, whether you're in Iowa or New York or Washington State, how can you be against jobs and rebuilding infrastructure? I mean, and the fact that we can't seems to me to be a real, I would say, a black eye on our democracy that we can't figure out how to do that.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a black eye on our political class that yeah. they have been so polarized that they cannot figure out how to do that.
So, all right. So let me, I think you're right on target. So now I'm going to push you and say, okay, to get a better political class, what are some of the things you'd recommend to get a more effective political class that could actually get the job done?
Well, this goes counter to what most people okay. think, but I believe that we have to inject into the political process some element of what we call peer review.
Oh.
Now, if you need brain surgery, you want a doctor who has been certified by other brain surgeons
right.
for his or her ability to crack your head open and mess around in your brain.
Okay.
If you want an electrician in your house, you want somebody who has been certified by other electricians as capable of doing that. Politics is the only area where we believe that anybody can do it. Well, we're seeing now that, no, not everybody can do it. And this president that we've just elected, the most inexperienced president ever in American history, and you see what's happening, okay? This is a government, a very chaotic government.
Right.
And if you believe in some of President Trump's goals in office, and if you voted for him because you sympathize with his goals, you've got to be shaking your head at his sheer inability to negotiate, even to get partially towards those goals.
So let me push you a little bit, because I think I agree with you, but I got two questions. One mm-hmm. is, okay, who's going to do the vetting, and who's going to do the certifying? And because, again, maybe I'm going to betray a little bit of my bias, we didn't do too well when we had a brain surgeon running for office, and I don't know what a brain surgeon knows about running housing. So, I mean...
Well, no, but that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point, is that the brain surgeon didn't know a thing about running housing, and he's not doing a very good job at it. No. I mean, look, for most of American history, until 1972, in fact, other politicians nominated people to run for president.
Right.
We had a nomination system that gave us Dwight D. Eisenhower, and it gave us Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
It gave us, because other politicians said two things. Is this person electable, and can this person govern? And that was the process. Now, it didn't always work great. We had some terrible presidents during this period of time. But basically, there was an element, all I'm saying, of peer review in the nomination process, not in the general election process. That's up to the people. We've lost that completely. And, of course, we've embarked upon a great experiment. And the great experiment has been nominating someone who knows absolutely nothing about government or politics and who lacks both the background and the temperament. And, you know, look, temperament is every bit as important as experience here. Temperament says you understand when you're president that you operate in a system of shared power, that you don't just go out and say, I want X done, and it happens. Doesn't work that way. The founding fathers made sure it didn't work that way because they didn't like kings very much. So the temperament aspect is also something that gets evaluated by other politicians. And let me just give you a perfect example of this. Imagine if President Trump, instead of running in primaries in front of throngs of enthusiastic supporters, had to go into a room with 5 governors, 4 senators, and if he said to them, I'm going to build a wall on the southern border, and I'm going to make Mexico pay for it. Now, frankly, to anybody with a little experience in government, both those statements, but particularly the second one, is patently ridiculous. And they would have said to him, you're going to do what? How are you going to do that? Do you really mean this? What, are you going to go to war and force them to pay for it? What are you talking about? Okay, that second statement, which he repeated throughout the campaign, was not ever a realistic statement. And that's the sort of thing where when you allow, this is demagoguery, when you allow politicians to make statements that have no basis in reality, and nobody steps in and says, no, that's impossible, you can't do that. And people say, people who are doing other things with their lives and don't pay attention all the time, and you can't blame them for it, say, gee, that sounds pretty good. I mean, boy, that sounds like a win-win, a wall, and they pay for it. Frankly, we've lost something in the system. Yeah. You need people who actually know what they're doing.
Professor and Dr. Kamot, thank you so much. I think I tend to agree with you. I think there should be some vetting and quality stuff. But as you began your introduction of the idea, it's saying that's a real heavy lift, because it basically says at the end of the day, we don't trust the voters to decide these things. And I'm not saying you're wrong, but it's a real heavy lift to get there. I wish I could figure out a way that we could get there, but
well, there are ways. I mean, there are pre-primary conventions,
right?
There are endorsements. There are ways for the political class to at least signal to the voters whether or not they think this person is qualified, and that's all I think you can hope for in this system is just some element of, does this person, do people who know what the job is think this person is actually capable of doing the job? That's all I'd ask for.
Great. So listen, thanks for spending the time with us, and thanks for the work that you're doing. I learned a lot, and I think it's our listeners did. So thanks so much for joining us on Just Love today.
Well, thanks for having me. Good luck to all of you, and God bless.
Thank you. Dr. Lane Kamot, who is the senior fellow in governance studies and the founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institute. So why don't we take a break? And when we'll come back, we'll learn a little bit about what's going on in the world in the news, okay? I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Wow. We're going to have a revolution, Fanny?
I guess so.
Okay, just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. So we are getting right to the end of the Christmas season. And I probably have mentioned this before, but I'm fascinated by it. So, okay, Fanny, when liturgically in our Catholic Church does the Christmas season end?
The baptism of Jesus?
Yes. Yep, the baptism
ding,
of Jesus.
Ding, ding.
Ding, ding. You get an award. Okay, so that's this very weekend.
Right.
Happen.
Okay. Yes.
All right. So, but here my other question is, if we went back many, many years ago,
okay,
when did it end? It was longer. I'll give you a hint.
I'm trying to think what's after the baptism. Well, the Epiphany just...
The Epiphany is before.
Not, right. Oh my goodness. What's after the baptism? I'm not sure.
It's not a biggie. You probably won't remember it. Jake, you got any idea?
February.
Well, you're right.
That's a good answer.
No, you're right. But what day or feast in February?
What's in February? Let's see.
And I'll give you a hint. Okay?
It's not the feast of February, is it?
No, it's not.
That would be too easy.
It's not the feast. And I'll give you another thing so you don't be stupid. It's not St. Valentine's Day either.
I was going to say that. Maybe it's St. Valentine's.
Yeah, I know. But I'll give you a hint. Okay. We like certain numbers in our church, right?
Yeah.
So one of the numbers we like is 40.
Okay.
Like Lent, 40 days
yes.
of Lent, 40 days in the desert, 40, blah, 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 blah. So.
I thought the baptism was 40.
It's not February 40th, is it? Because that would technically be March. That would be like March 9th or whatever.
No. The baptism.
Is not 40?
Epiphany is 12, right?
Oh, it is.
And baptism is
another 7.
You don't have to be a math major yeah. to figure out it's not that.
But it is 40. So what is 40? I feel like I know this, but I'm not.
40 is February 2nd, the Feast of the Presentation.
Oh, the presentation.
That used okay. to be the end of the Christmas season.
All right, got
when
it.
When Jesus
but
got
that's weird then, because obviously the presentation happened first and the baptism way later in life. He was 30.
Right.
So why did they switch it to...
You don't want to go there.
Okay.
You don't want to go there.
Okay.
Okay, because if we begin the year in January...
Yes.
He dies before he's born.
Yes. That's what yeah. I'm saying. Everything's
so
kind of backwards.
Yeah, don't go there, okay?
Okay,
just, you know, there's no end. There's no there.
Okay.
Okay, so anyway, end of the Christmas season, we did this thing with the Latter-day Saints.
Yes.
In which there was this giving machine.
Yes.
Up by Lincoln Center in New York City, and it was a machine where people could go up to the machine and... Instead of buying a candy bar or instead of buying an whatever you buy,
soda.
You could make a contribution
right.
to buy something or buy the equivalent something that would help a poor family internationally in New York. So what's the – we got the cash register results for
yes.
what they did. Tell us, what happened?
So we – it's funny because we got the transactions back in December and then we just got a new one this
okay.
week. And they're just for Catholic Charities because we also mm. had other organizations that partnered with Latter-day Saints. But we have 428 transactions, and the total number of cash flow for that was $12,381.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And what were our big ticket items?
So people love children, obviously. So one of the things that we had in the vending machine was a kid's Christmas essentials. Under that, the second thing, the second most popular was children's winter boots. And then right under that was a basketball.
I gave a basketball.
You did.
I gave a basketball.
So you contributed it to the top three.
Yay! That's good. That's good. Okay, so we got something else in the news, Fanny. How
yes.
about we got something on food intolerance and food allergy?
Yeah. So I don't have any allergies myself that
okay.
I know of. I mean, I know the body kind of changes as you get older, but...
So when I went to the doctor to get stitches mm-hmm. for the cut I did the other day, they asked if I was allergic to anything. And
yeah.
I said in big letters, bold, and shouted, pain. I'm allergic to pain.
Me
so
too.
Don't hurt me.
That's a okay. good one. So am I. So I wonder if, you know, New Yorkers know that just because you think you have a food allergy, that means you have a food allergy. So a new research suggests that Americans may be over-diagnosing themselves with food allergies. A study published in the medical journal JAMA Network Open estimates that nearly 19% of adults think they have food allergies, but less than 11% actually do. So millions of Americans who think that they have a food allergy are actually just suffering from a food intolerance, according to the study. So for the study, the researchers, they researched or surveyed 40,000 adults from across the United States, and they were asked if during these surveys, if they went to the doctor and if a doctor actually, you know, told them that they had an allergy, et cetera. And if they found out that most of these people that think that they have a food allergy actually never got a diagnosed allergy. So it may be just a food intolerance that people
have. All right,
have.
But Fanny, you're going to be upset.
Why?
Because what's the question I'm going to ask now? Jake,
what's
what question am I going to ask Fanny now?
I have no idea.
What's the difference between food intolerance and a food allergy?
Well, I think that a food allergy, obviously, you get rashes and it's
right.
a life-threatening thing. A food intolerance isn't. It's more of a discomfort. So it's not life-threatening. That's the difference between both. Most
well,
people
all right,
have
so
a life-threatening...
Okay, so me, not a doctor, not whatever. Here's what I'd say, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Some people think they have a big food allergy and they got a baby food allergy.
That's the difference. Big, a mama food allergy or a baby food allergy?
Okay.
Which one are you?
Or a papa bear.
Or a papa bear.
A papa bear food allergy seems to me like that you go,
right, and that's
you die.
It, you're done.
Like that's nuts and like, thing. You know, if
right.
you do that.
Right.
Yeah. A mama is like, you know, rashes and stuff like
yeah.
that. And a baby is,
Yeah.
You know, like you.
So a baby one would be an intolerance to.
Okay.
Whatever.
And what do you call like me? Like sushi?
What do you feel when you eat sushi?
Yicky. Because I don't like it.
Oh, well, that's nothing.
that's important
to
me.
You know what? When I read that article, I actually thought, because I know a lot of people who are picky with food.
Right.
And they think that they're allergic to things. And okay. I'm like, I just think that you just don't like certain things. So you think you have an allergy, but you actually don't.
No. You claim you have an allergy.
Right, you claim.
So you don't have to eat it.
Exactly.
But I mean, I'm not a picky eater. I like lots of things, but there are a few things like God created fire, Jake, right?
Right.
He did.
And so I think it's not being kind to God's gift of fire to have food that's not cooked.
Fair enough. I do love sushi, though.
So do I.
I mean, I'll light a fire and maybe do like a fondue after the sushi
here's the issue. Any sushi I get, I'll give to you guys.
Oh.
Perfect.
That's perfect.
And then, but I'll go to sushi restaurants as long as I can have tempura or stuff that's cooked. They usually have stuff that's
California
cooked.
California roll, I think, is just shrimp, cooked shrimp.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I think that's the most cooked roll I've
had
in
California.
Cooked.
Yeah. Okay. I make those sometimes. Yeah.
All right. So, let's do one more and then we'll take a break. Because one of the things that we've talked about all the time is healthcare is pretty important.
Yes.
And even though with the changes in the past, 5 years or so, millions more people have been covered, which is great. But there are still millions who are not covered throughout the country.
Yes.
So what's going on in New York City to try to reach some of those people who are still not covered by any health insurance?
Yeah, so there are 600,000 uninsured residents in New York City right now.
Okay.
But Mayor Bill de Blasio just announced this past Tuesday the comprehensive health care for all New Yorkers who need it. So the direct comprehensive care also includes 300,000 undocumented New Yorkers. So those who can afford it will pay on a sliding scale, but those who can't, then we'll get free coverage. And the health insurance, it's not actual health insurance. It's a city paying for direct comprehensive care for those who can't afford it, including undocumented immigrants. So the $100 million plan will roll out this year for Bronx residents. And they will roll out to the other four boroughs by 2021.
Okay, good deal. Let's see how it works. Okay, let's take a break. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Just Love. Thank you for joining us on Just Love, and we'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Our weekly conversation about what's going on in the world, which we look at through the prism of our Catholic social values. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. Our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. So when we talk about, we look about what's going on in the world through religious values, we know there's a wide spectrum of religious people in the world. And we know within our Catholic tradition, there are those who, let's just say it, are more devout. They practice a lot more. Probably at one of those extremes are monasteries and monks and nuns who are in cloistered monasteries trying to live out their faith in that way. And then there are people living in the world who you wouldn't recognize by their garb or anything different, just walking down the street. And there's a lot of variations in between that. And so what I'm delighted that we have a guest today, Dr. David Myers, who is professor of Jewish history in the Department of History at University of California, Los Angeles, to kind of talk to us a little bit about how do religious communities kind of live in the modern world and still maintain their traditions. And obviously, he has a lot of experience with the Jewish community, and so we're going to talk about that. Dr. Myers, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love.
Great pleasure to be with you.
Well, so how'd you wind up in California? Because you're not originally from California, are you?
No, I'm not. I've been in California for almost 30 years, which is the source of daily amazement and amusement, I have to say, since I'm an East Coast guy. I'm a Jewish guy from Scranton, Pennsylvania, which is a town with a pronounced Catholic influence. In fact, I spent a year in lieu of my senior year of high school at the local Catholic college, the University of Scranton.
Ah.
Where I was introduced to the great Jesuit canon of learning, and I still have strong relations with the university and its great president, Father Scott Pilares. I was educated on the East Coast and in Israel, and I followed my wife, who is a professor of law, out to Los Angeles when she took up a job at the University of Southern California. I finished my dissertation, and lo and behold, a job opened up in my small little field, Jewish history, at UCLA, and I've been there ever since 1991.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us today on Just Love. So let's go right to the issue, which I'd love to discuss, is how do we deal with kind of very rigorous religious communities, and how do they interact with modernity? And obviously, in the Jewish community, you know, most of us, you know, without knowing a lot of detail, can say, oh, yeah, there are Reform Jews, there are conservative Jews, there are Orthodox Jews, and then there are even more to the little bit more rigorous than Orthodox. How does the Jewish community deal with that in terms of kind of existing in the modern world and being part of that tradition?
Right. Well, that is the great question of modern Jewish history, how to balance tradition and modernity. And the various denominations that you mentioned, Monsignor, from Reform to traditionalist or ultra-Orthodox, all represent different answers to the question of how to strike that balance between tradition and modernity. It's important to note that all of those denominations are themselves products of modernity. They're all modern inventions, and it reminds us that religion changes over time. And it also reminds us of the fact that in the great modern secular era, religion doesn't disappear. It is transformed. We see in the Jewish case the invention of a new category known as Orthodoxy, which didn't exist until the 19th century. And then within Orthodoxy, a division between modern Orthodox and traditionalist or ultra-Orthodox. Modern Orthodox have as their guiding credo Torah, traditional Jewish learning and scripture, and science. They openly embrace the modern world and all that it has to offer, and seek to integrate that modern perspective into their view of tradition. Ultra-Orthodoxy, or traditionalist orthodoxy, regards modernity as not just a challenge, but as a source of contamination. and something that must be contained and in a certain sense cordoned off. And yet at the same time, it's important to note that ultra-Orthodoxy is itself a product of modernity. So I would say that all of these denominational strands that you mentioned are themselves attempts to answer that question of tradition and modernity. Reform Jews also believe that they are beholden to the tradition, but in very different ways than ultra-Orthodox Jews regard tradition.
So let me ask this, how does this fit into another concept, which, you know, I grew up in New York, live in New York, and as some of the old ads used to say, when you came to almost any ethnic group or religious group, there are more of that particular ethnic group than in where they came from. Right. I mean, I remember there are more Irish in New York than there are in Dublin. There are more blah, 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 blah. So there's a wonderfully robust Jewish community in New York. But one of the phrases that kind of comes up periodically, well, you know, I'm a cultural Jew. I'm not a religious Jew. And sometimes for those of us who are Christian and Catholic, makes no sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. It's a category that doesn't make sense. It's important to note that New York is the largest Jewish city in the world by several orders of magnitude.
Right.
Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, second and third, Los Angeles, fourth. And in New York, at its Jewish community, you see the entire world. You see the entire Jewish diaspora represented. And within that Jewish universe, you also see a wide range of cultural and religious expressions. So you can go from the Upper West Side and sort of the heart of the Jewish intellectual and cultural tradition, not necessarily connected to traditional religious observance, and then make your way out to Brooklyn, where you will see strictly Orthodox neighborhoods featuring many different varieties of the traditionally observant Jews. The very characterization of someone as a cultural Jew reflects the fact that Judaism or Jewish identity really stands on the border between traditional religious observance and belief and ethnicity and a sense of peoplehood. And in the modern age, we have seen that many, many Jews have forsworn traditional religious observance, but nonetheless continue to identify as Jews. And one of the most important catalysts in pushing forward this sense of Jewish identity is the presence of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism continually has served to remind Jews of their distinctiveness when they themselves have given up many of the traditional defining features that existed before modern times. There's a good aphorism that captures it, delivered by the great German thinker who moved to America, a German Jewish thinker, Hannah Arendt, when she said, "From Judaism, one could escape through conversion. From Jewishness, there is no escape." So, in other words, from that sort of modern sense that you are indelibly a Jew, especially in the eyes of the anti-Semite, you can't escape. And that sense, that what I would call almost a negative criterion of Jewish identity, has been a very pronounced force in Jewish life in the last 2.5 centuries.
So we only have a few minutes left, but thoughts on, I know you've done a lot about, one of the issues that I think we're dealing with in the New York suburbs is a place like Kiryas Joel and some of the school districts up there. How does that play itself out?
Yeah. Well, so Kiryas Joel is a very, very interesting community about which my wife, whom I mentioned a minute ago, a legal scholar, and I just finished a big book, which will be coming out, we hope, in a year or so.
Well, I hope when the book comes out, just tease it and you'll come back. Maybe both of you come back and you can kind of can talk. So, but just tease it for us.
Yes. So this is a community of strictly observant Jews who followed their charismatic rabbi, who happened to be named Joel, hence the name Kiryas Joel, which means village of Joel in Hebrew. Pardon me?
No ego there.
No. Well, he was a remarkably charismatic character who is still mentioned with extraordinary reverence and adulation to this day. So it would be unimaginable for residents in the community to name it anything other than after the founding rabbi. Right. Anyway, these are a group of Hasidic Jews who survived the Holocaust, made their way to New York in the aftermath of the Second World War, settled in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, and then the rabbi said, we need to find a place outside of the city, away from the seductions and allures of a teeming urban environment, okay, where we can live our life as we want to do it, according to, as the phrase, the resonant phrase constantly has it, according to the path of ancient Israel. That was what really inspired Rabbi Teitelbaum. And the image that he had in mind was of the classic Eastern European shtetl, or Jewish town. Interestingly enough, the classic Eastern European shtetl, or Jewish town, was never wholly Jewish. So it's another interesting case of the invention of a new idea here in America, because Rabbi Teitelbaum really did imagine a fully holistic, organic, completely Jewish town. He began to ask his advisors to seek out property in the New York area already in the late 40s, early 50s.
Hey, Dr. Myers, I'm going to have to cut you off. We got a tease, but you're coming back. I hope you will, because we got a lot more to talk about, Curious Joe and other things. So please, join us again, and we'll spend some more time talking. But thank you so much for
taking
the time today. Just Love, I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about what's going on in the world through our perspective of values. Thanks for being with us. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.